The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
So when you think of Ruth, at least coming up, growing up, I always thought of Ruth as this love story, right? So I'd skip it. Like, I didn't want to have anything to do with a love story. And it is, and it's a love story of enormous magnitude. It's quite incredible. I'm not really a romantic guy, and so I as we look at this through Acts, because we're going to look at it through four Acts. So today is Act One. I was kind of thinking of love stories. What are good love stories that you can kind of, it's up there with Ruth. And of course, my wife's favorite is The Notebook. So I know some of you are, I would say, amen to that. But it's The Notebook. And then probably my favorite was the Titanic, and it's because that's when my wife tried to make a move on me for the first time, and tried to kiss me, and don't tell her I said this, but it was during Titanic, and so that's probably my top for that reason alone. And but my favorite love story of all time, and you're going to laugh, which is actually in my top five favorite movies of all time. Only behind Elf, Gladiator, and Braveheart. Maybe The Natural. But those four. Number five for me, you ready for this? Is the movie Signs. Have you ever seen the movie Signs? And so it is a love story. Don't judge me here. But the movie Signs, if you've never seen the movie Signs, you're going to have to go all the way back to 2002. Like, it is the closest to Ruth of all movies, right? In a sense. And here's what I mean. So if you haven't seen it, they start the movie off and you get introduced to these characters, right? So you have Mel Gibson, who's this priest that's kind of walked away from his faith because his wife is tragically killed by a man that falls asleep behind the wheel and hits her, runs over her. So what you see in the beginning of this movie is you see all these characters and you see how tragic this event is because he's got a son that has terrible asthma to the point where it could kill him. You have a daughter that is distraught from losing her mother that's infatuated with water, which is really weird. And there's water all over the house. And then you have this washed-out baseball player who couldn't make it in the minor leagues, so he's come back to help take care of the kids. And the whole thing is just sad, right? And on top of that, you ready for this? This is a love story. And on top of that, aliens are attacking. Like, so that's the gist of the movie. And so you get to the end. So I'm going to, it's 2002, so if you ain't watched it, you're not watching it now. But so you get to the end of the movie, right? And the aliens, there's one alien left, and he's in their house, and he's got the son in his arms who's having an asthma attack, who's dying, right? So something has to be done, and the alien starts to spray like poison on him. I don't know what it is. It's coming out of his arm. It's weird. And so he's spraying the poison on him, and then all of a sudden, Mel Gibson starts to think, and he starts paying attention to the signs, right? And there's a baseball bat. So if he's got a baseball bat in it, you know it's good. There's a baseball bat on the wall, and he tells his brother to swing away. So his brother grabs the bat, and he starts hitting the alien, and all of a sudden, water pours on the alien, and they figure out that's what kills the alien, right? So I know some of you are like, what is he doing? Yo, hold on. And so he starts knocking the water on the alien, and the alien starts to die. Mel Gibson grabs his kid, takes him outside, and is praying to God that his lungs were closed in the moment from the asthma. And all of a sudden he wakes up, right? And then he starts to think of this conversation he has with his wife, and she says, pay attention to the sign. Everything matters. Nothing is by mistake. Right? So you think about the story, and as you jump into Ruth, what you're going to see that every single part of these four acts matters. And with that being said, here we go. So Ruth is a story that shows us how God moves in a mysterious way. It's a story of people who wonder where God is when there are no dreams or visions or prophets. It's for people who wonder where God is when one tragedy after another attacks their faith. It's a story for people who wonder whether a life of integrity in tough times is worth it. And it's a story for people who can't imagine that anything great could ever come out of their ordinary lives. That's the story, on top of being a love story. And it comes on the back end of Judges. So if you want a really feel-good book, read Judges. And what you'll see in Judges is things are really bad. As a matter of fact, Judges ends with this, saying in chapter 21, verse 25, it says this: "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes." It was a free-for-all. It was a mess. And what you see is this pattern in the midst of very dark time, that God's people would sin, and then God would send enemies against them, and they would cry out, and then God would raise up a judge that would deliver them. And again and again and again, they rebelled. And so from a distance, as you read the book, what you see, what you feel, is that maybe God is losing here. Maybe God's purpose for righteousness and glory in Israel is not going to happen. And then you get this really small glimpse of hope in the book of Ruth. And here are the two questions. So this is where we're going to keep coming back to over the next 4 weeks. Simply this: is God in control? Do you believe that God is in control? Is he sovereign? Number two is, does he care? Like, think of things that you have walked through in your life, maybe that you're currently walking through. Those questions come to mind, right? Is he really in control, and does he really care? And this is not a book that's just at a national level, right? It's not just about the Israelites. But what you'll see is it is at a personal, family level. And that God is at work in the worst of times. And just when you think he's furthest from you, just when you think he's turned his back on you, just when you think he's non-existent, the truth is he's laying foundation stones of a greater happiness in your life and in my life. I was reading an old hymn this week that I think just sums up Ruth, and this is what it says: "Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face." You see, in the first five verses, and what we're going to do over the next several weeks is we're going to read it, and then we're just going to kind of break it down. And this is where you want to take some notes. But remember what I said: everything in the story matters. So from the very beginning, you get introduced to these characters. You got Elimelech and his wife Naomi, and they're leaving Bethlehem. Now, here's what's interesting. The word Bethlehem, so they're in the middle of a famine, but the word Bethlehem means house of bread, right? So they're leaving the house of bread, and they're leaving because a famine has come. Now, there's a lot of things here that you're going to tend to want to assume, and it may be that they're true, but we don't know that for sure. So we don't know exactly why they're leaving, but they're leaving to go to Moab. And if you know what Moab is Moab was enemies of God, right? So they came out of the family of Lot. So if you know the story of Lot, Lot has a child with his oldest daughter, so not a good start. And Lot has a child with his oldest daughter that leads to this group of people, right? So they were enemies of God. So you've got this man named Elimelech, whose name actually means "my God is king," okay? So "my God is king" is leaving. He's leaving the land to go to where the enemies are, right, with his wife and his two sons. So that's the picture here. So automatically what you see is, well, of course, this guy's disobedient, right? Well, we don't know that. So that they leave, and in that 10-year time, Elimelech dies. Like, he dies, and then his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, they take two wives, two Moabite wives, which, again, God had said, don't do this before. And so they take these two wives to be their wives, and at the end of the 10 years, what happens, in both of their names, he actually means death and weakness, and both of these guys pass away. They die. So you get this feeling of, okay, God, are you in control? okay, God, what good can come out of this, right? So now you got three widows, one who's old in age. She won't have any more kids. She's barren. And then you have two daughter-in-laws, right, that have no kids in enemy territory, right, with no hope. So in those days, if you were a widow with no children, you were worse off than a slave. So they're in enemy land, three ladies together, wondering where God's at. So you see this picture, it kind of gets set up. So you see where Naomi's misery is coming from, right? So you see it. So starting in verse 11, look what she says. Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. So here's what she's saying. Listen, I've got nothing for you. You've got no chance at all if you're going to stay with me. Go on your way. Which is interesting because at least if they stayed, I mean, that was their place. That's where they grew up. That's who they knew. Surely they had family there. They had some chance if they stayed. And you see the misery in her voice, and you see the bitterness in her tone as she tells them to go on their way. And the custom, again, of the time was if you were an Israelite and a husband died, then the brother or the closest relative would step in and marry the woman so the line would continue. And what she's saying is there's no chance at this. Like, there's no one. Which is really interesting because if you think about it, how many times in life, because there is a lesson here, right? How many times in life when we have decided that God is against us, that we begin to exaggerate our hopelessness, right? Think about it. Think about those times in your life where you've been in the valley, or think about those times when you feel like you're so low, and what happens in those moments is you just say, well, God surely is against me. It's hopeless. So what happens? It blinds us. And that's what's happening here. She's being blinded by her situation. Because if you notice in verse 6, what does it say? That God had stopped the famine, right? And not only did God stop the famine, think about this. He stopped it. They're in enemy territory, 30 miles away, and all of a sudden now they get word that the famine has stopped. What are the chances of that? So these miracles are starting to take place, but she's in such a low, dark spot, she can't even see him. And there is no mention of repentance. It's just God working in the darkness. So you see what happens. Orpah, which I'm probably going to say Oprah several times before it's over with, but Orpah, she says, okay, I'm out. And there's no reason for her not to be out, so she should go. But we see something in Ruth here that's very important. Look, I'm going to read this again. Starting in verses 16 through 17. Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if even death parts from you. So if you read this at your wedding, or you're thinking about reading this at your wedding, do remember this is between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law, which is a little weird. But these words are incredible here, right? Because what you start to see is a picture of who Ruth is, right? Like, you see this commitment to Naomi that's unbelievable. First of all, it means that if she does this, she's leaving her own family, she's leaving her own land, she's leaving her all she knows to follow her mother-in-law, right? Secondly, it means, as far as she knows currently, that she will be a widow and never be a mother for her entire life, right? As far as she knows, that's the way it looks. Third, it means she's going into a new land, which, according to the way she grew up, would have been considered her enemy. Like, I'm going into a new land with new customs, new language. Fourth, it was a commitment that was so radical, even more radical than marriage, because what does she say? Where you die, I will die, and there be buried. So what she's saying is, I'm never going to ever come back to my homeland. When you die, wherever it is that you die, that's where I'll be. And then fifth, your God will be my God. Did y'all just read the same thing? She just kind of laid it out, right? Like, God's hand's against me. My life is miserable. So if you're going to follow me, this is what you're following. And Ruth is saying, well, I get it. Like, that's what I'm picking up. So I'm gonna follow you and your God. You're the same God that you said his hand is against you will be my God. Wow. Right? And we don't know. Again, there's a lot of things we don't know. We don't know that maybe that when she was married before that her husband told her of God, right? Maybe. Maybe she heard of the stories of Moses and the Red Sea being departed. Maybe she did. But we don't know that. But here's what we know from that statement. We see someone that has faith in God that sees beyond the present bitter setbacks, don't we? Someone that has faith in God no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the setbacks. We also see this, that she has freedom from the securities and comforts of the world, right? Because what she's choosing is, I'm going to follow not knowing what I'm getting into, whether I'm going to be homeless, whether I'm going to be starving. I'm committed to this lady. And I have no idea what's ahead. And then third, the courage to venture into an unknown strange area. Enemies to her. Fourth, she's radically committed in a relationship appointed by God. What would our lives look like if this is what we truly embraced? Right? It's incredible. And then, but the truth is as I read this week over and over and over again, the truth is I feel like more of my life looks like Naomi's, right? And not that she completely got it wrong. As they get to verse 19, look what happens. It says, do not call me Naomi, right? So what that means is pleasant. Naomi means pleasant and sweet. So she's come back home, and she's back with her people. She says, call me Mara, which means bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has afflicted me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So you kind of see the scene, right? So she comes home. You can imagine the gossip, right? Everybody's talking. Like, she leaves with a husband. She leaves with two healthy sons. They walk away in the midst of the famine. And now she's back. And now she's back with nobody but a daughter-in-law. Like, everybody's gone. So you know the talk is, well, this is God against her because she disobeyed. And she's playing the part, right? She even changes her name. But here's three things that I want you to notice that we see in this that she does get right. First of all, she never denies that God exists. Right? Like, you never see that she said, well, God, surely God doesn't exist because all of this is happening. So she never forgets that, and she never forgets that God is sovereign. The word Almighty here is referring to the sovereignty of God, and she says it over and over and over again. But the problem again is that what she sees is this affliction that's come upon her. That's all she can see. So instead of opening her eyes to the signs of God's merciful purposes in her life, all she sees is affliction. And what's crazy is God's already started the miracles. Like she's been brought out of famine back home, which is miracle number one. And she doesn't even realize there's a kinsman that's waiting. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. So what does that mean for us, right? Because one of the things you want to do here, I know we want to jump ahead, right? But I don't want us to jump ahead today. Because I think we're all in so many different places in life. We've been in different places in life. But remember what we said to start with, that we, first of all, do you believe that God is in control? Because he is. He's all-encompassing. He's all-pervading reality. And the truth is, in both of these ladies, in the midst of doubt, even though their perspective may be different, the one thing they never stop believing or denying is that God is, he's sovereign. In the midst of all of it. And the other thing we see here is that his ways, his providence is a mystery. And it's very difficult sometimes. We said it a couple weeks ago. It's kind of like looking into a jagged piece of glass. We don't see it all. And perhaps, a lot of perhaps, but perhaps, you know, because what she thinks, what Naomi thinks, is this has all come upon her because of a disobedience. And we don't know that. But here's the truth. Psalms 34:19 says this: many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. What does that mean? That means that all things that happen to me and you in life don't necessarily mean it's because of sin in your life. It's not always that. Sometimes it's just living in a broken world, but that does not mean that God's not sovereign. That does not mean that God's still in control. Now, here's what's beautiful about it, because the Old Testament and New Testament both agree with this, but listen to this. Even if it is because of her disobedience, even if it is because of her family's disobedience that all of this has happened, what does this show us? That even in our sin, listen to me, because this is huge. Even in our sin, he can turn our judgments into joys. If Ruth was brought into the family by sin, it's even more astonishing that she would be made the grandmother of David. That's as far as you're going to get today. But that she would become the grandmother of David. In the midst of so much brokenness, in the midst of so much darkness, God's mercy and grace is working. Don't ever think that the sin of your past means there is no hope for your future. It doesn't work that way. And then the third thing is that God's good purposes are evident. Right? Not only does God reign in the affairs of men, and not only is his providence sometimes hard, but in all his works, his purposes are for the good and the happiness of his people. Like, that's why we say read Judges, because if you read Judges, you would see how bad these times are, and you wouldn't have imagined in these times, because this is on the back end of that, that God was quietly moving in the tragedies of one single family. And what we learn from Ruth is that God right now is at work for your future and for your hope. He's breaking through the clouds. And our hope is a blessed assurance. It's like, oh, well, maybe God will show up. And then the final thing is this. Ruth feels the freedom of it, right? If you trust the sovereign goodness and the mercy of God to pursue you all the days of your life, then you will feel free like Ruth. How free was she? I'm in. I'm committed. I have no idea where I'm going. My life looks like I'll never have an identity. But I'm going to be obedient wherever you lead. Listen, when you believe in the sovereignty of God and that he loves to work mightily for those who trust him, it gives us a freedom and joy that cannot be shaken, not even in the hardest of times. I was reading in, I've been reading through Romans, because we're gonna land in Romans, hopefully in the fall. So I don't know if I was supposed to tell you that, but I just did. But I was reading in Romans this week, and just reminded in Romans 15, starting in verse 4. For whatever was written in the former day was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the scriptures, we may have hope, assurance. I'm going to ask the team to come up. But I was praying this week in the midst of this because, I don't know, I look across the room this morning and I recognize many stories that I know. I know people are currently who are going through crazy hard times, whether it be loss of job, whether it be sickness, whether it be loss of family members. It's been a hard year. It's been dark in so many ways. It's been tough. And as we look at this first act, as we look at these characters, I think for so many of us, we may relate more with Naomi this morning, right? God, I know you're sovereign, but I'm not really sure if you're for my good. I don't see it. I don't see the signs. And some of that is because we're in such a spot that it's hard to see. My prayer this morning is that we would embrace the moments, that we would step back. Listen, it's so much easier. It is. It's so much easier to see God in our rearview mirror, isn't it? So much easier. But what would it look like if we recognized him in the moments, in the hard times, that we would see those signs? And then there's other of us that our lives really are, they seem more like Ruth, right now? Like we've walked, we've seen, we've been on that side of it. Maybe we're not there right now. Maybe we're on the mountaintop. Listen, this applies to us too, because here's an opportunity for you to walk along someone that may be in the midst of something. Maybe this is a chance for you to step in and say, hey, listen, I've been there. Let me walk with you through this. Let me remind you who's sovereign in this story. Because it's crazy, because you think of Naomi, and in the midst of all this, she grew up listening to these stories. She was reminded of Joseph, what Joseph went through. But even in the midst, how about that? Even in the midst, that she would be able to recognize God as being sovereign. Listen, a couple years ago, I wasn't going to share this because I didn't really want to cry this morning. But it's been 15 years ago. Sarah and I had two miscarriages, and that's a whole other great story. I'm not even going to talk about that. But I was in a bad spot. You know, because the tendency is, oh, Lord, I followed you all my life. Where are you at? What are you doing? What good? Are you really in control? Do you really care about me? I was angry, and I remember I was driving down Reedville Road after work one day, and I just had a rough day. And typically I'd pray on the way home. I was like, you know what? I don't even feel like praying. I don't even know if you're listening. So I turned the radio on, and this preacher was talking of this story, of course. He said he had a child that had a chromosome issue, so there were a lot of mental things that weren't right. And he had had trouble connecting with his son through the years, but he loved football. They were huge Titan fans, so you're going to have to go way back here. So he thought what he would do would be to surprise his son and get him tickets to the Super Bowl. So it was whatever Super Bowl that was, where it was St. Louis and Tennessee. So for a preacher, that's not a cheap thing to come by, but he made it happen. And so they get to the Super Bowl, and he said they were having a blast. They were buying every refreshment, everything he could do just to make the day even. You know, they had T-shirts. They coming out with the number one fingers and everything else going up to find their seat. And they start walking up to find their seat, and he starts to panic a little bit because he said, I bought these tickets, and I knew exactly where the seat was, and as I went to where I thought they were, they kept pushing me further up. And what he realized is when he couldn't go any further, he was at the very top corner of the stadium. And he said, I was extremely disappointed because I'd done everything to make this day special, and you couldn't see anything. And he said before he could say anything to apologize to his son looked at him and said, man, Dad, how much did these tickets cost? He said, why? He said, you must have paid a ton because these are the best seats in the house. We can see what the blimp can see. We can see what the blimp can see. Man, if only we could see what the blimp could see. Pay attention to the signs. The story gets crazier and crazier. Massive. Let's pray. I hear you. Lord, we love you because you loved us first. What more can we say? In the darkness, in the suffering, I mean, even when it seems like you're just absent, you're not, and you're working, Lord, let us rest in that. May we rest and knowing that you are at work for our good. Thank you for your son. Thank you for loving us so much that you would go to a cross and die and rise again for the joy that was laid before you. Lord, move in a mighty way this next several weeks as we step into Easter. Remind us, Lord, let us be intentional about looking into each other's lives. And if there are ones that are in the midst of hard times, may we be like Ruth. Lord, if we are the one in the midst of the darkness right now, wrap your arms around us. Remind us that you are working. Let us see that. We ask this in your precious holy name. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.